Making psychological concepts really simple and actionable and practical is, I think, really important to broadening, you know, the appeal for, you know, the people that don't naturally have an inclination towards it and the ones who are more skeptical. Can't fix a problem that you can't see in the moment, right? And if you see the opportunity afterwards, right, whether it's a, you know, a trading opportunity, right, it's gone, the money's gone, right? If you don't see that you are pissed off prior to actually taking a trade for the third time after getting stopped out twice, if you don't see that ahead of time, right, you're going to take the third trade and you're going to lose, right? And so it's just a skill that you can train over time. It's not some mythical, you know, magical ability for people to be aware of their emotions. Trading in the Zone is a fantastic book, but I think the criticism tends to be like, okay, this is great, but how do I turn it into, you know, a transformational big difference in my mentality? And you know, to a degree, kind of that was what I was experiencing myself. That's what I, you know, have kind of done differently in my book.
Welcome to the AlphaMind podcast, where we seek to explore, examine, and illuminate the mental, emotional, and behavioral challenges of trading and investing. The AlphaMind podcast is co-hosted by Stephen Goldstein and Mark Randall. Today's guest is mental game coach Jared Tendler. Jared is the author of a new book called The Mental Game of Trading. Jared has worked previously as a mental game coach with golfers and poker players and has written extensively about the mental game of poker. The mental aspect of trading is probably the hardest and most challenging part to manage and overcome. You can be strong technically and have a great process or system, but it is the mental side which often causes the most frustration for traders. This is not dissimilar to what happens in sports and gaming. Hence, this is why we were so keen to talk to Jared, who has made dealing with this aspect so central to his work. Before we start, a few words about our sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, and their brilliant Technical Analysis Home Study Course. The Home Study Course is an online version of the full program, which is taught at the London School of Economics. If you are keen to develop your technical analysis skills and take your knowledge and understanding of them to the very highest level, then this is the program you should be considering. We are delighted to announce that the STA are offering a discount on the full cost of the Home Study Course and the Home Study Course and Diploma program to listeners of the AlphaMind podcast. To find out more about the Home Study Course and how to get the exclusive AlphaMind discount, visit the AlphaMind blog page, where you will find a link to the Home Study Course at the top of the page. Go to alphamindblog.blogspot.com or just Google AlphaMind Blog. Now, on with this week's podcast.
Well, welcome to this week's AlphaMind podcast, and we're delighted to have Jared Tendler with us. Jared is an internationally recognized mental game coach. He's got a book coming out soon that we're very interested in, The Mental Game of Trading. But his clients include world champion poker players, the number one ranked pool player in the world, professional golfers, and financial traders. Currently serves as the mental game coach to the largest sport organization in the world, Team Liquid. And he is author of two highly acclaimed books, shortly to be three, The Mental Game of Poker 1 and 2, and The Mental Game Itself. So, Jared, welcome to the show. Tell us more about your story. We're intrigued.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I appreciate that prognostication on the third book. yeah, so I've, you know, you kind of did a great intro of the highlights of my background. You know, I just to kind of give a little bit of backstory, you know, I really am, you know, kind of at my heart like an athlete. You know, as a competitive golfer, played at a pretty high level in college. I was three-time All-American, won 9 times. So, I mean, really was on the track of wanting to play professional golf. That was kind of my, you know, kind of origin story, so to speak, but was kind of derailed by some instances where I was choking under, you know, high pressure moments. Tried to qualify for the US Open in 1997. For those that don't know, there's sort of two stages of qualifying. The first stage, you know, is for all the schlubs like me. But I played, you know, the best golf of my life, tee to green, hit 16 greens, really was like almost perfect. But missed, you know, 3 to 4 short putts, end up missing the cut by a shot. And if I'd qualified, I would have basically gone to, you know, a modified PGA Tour event, because the US Open, only about 50 players actually qualify. Everybody else has to qualify. Only 50 qualify automatically. So long story short is that was kind of the first indication that, you know, the mind actually had an impact on your performance, and it kind of kept happening. So, you know, through this process, I dive into sports psychology. Bob Rotella was, you know, kind of big at the time, and you know, kind of the general psychology, golf psychology, and in large measure, it really did help propel me. So this was all through college, and you know, I was continuing to get better and better, except in those critical moments when it mattered most and I kept failing. So, you know, realizing that I was either going to have to get overcome this to be a professional, you know, or maybe it was, you know, a direction that I wasn't the only one struggling with this, you know, that this traditional sports psychology, you know, probably helped, you know, a decent number of people, but there probably were others like me who it didn't. And so I decided to get a double major in business and psychology undergrad, got a master's degree in counseling psychology, spent 2 years, 3,200 hours getting licensed as a traditional therapist with no intent to practice. I just wanted to learn the skill set of a therapist, which, you know, got deeper into problems. And effectively what I created was this sort of hybrid of sports psychology that I would kind of call, you know, like where we're operating on this level of these performance flaws, right? High expectations, illusions of control, you know, hatred of mistakes. You know, in the trading book, there's over 20, 25 of these, you know, kind of individual flaws that tend to show up in performance. And when you operate on that level, you can create kind of sustainable, like resolution of the core problem. Like me choking was just a symptom. So to kind of put it all together, you know, after I got my master's, I quit and went out to Arizona to start working with golfers. Was under the delusion that golfers actually wanted to do this work. Quickly found out that they're, you know, full of shit, like a lot of people. They, you know, in large measure, just were not willing to do the work. I think they wanted the quick fixes. They wanted just to buy new sets of clubs. You know, some of the tour players and, you know, they, of course, wanted to work. But, you know, I was still young and, you know, kind of slowly building a roster. And it turns out that I kind of found a niche in professional poker as I met a poker player on the golf course. And that kind of took off because now you had all these sort of amateur poker players, as well as professional poker players, who had a direct incentive to improve their mentality because they couldn't go and buy clubs. They couldn't go practice on the range for hours. The only way to practice really was to go play, and their money was on the line. So, you know, the impact of tilt and anger and fear and confidence issues were really pretty impactful. So it just gave me a huge opportunity to, you know, really develop my competence, develop my program. And that's kind of what got me into the field. And so, you know, the joke I always say is that, ironically, at the time that poker came up as an opportunity, I actually was playing professional golf. I had cured my issues. I was starting to do well. I, you know, had a 63 in a very big kind of competitive match. And I was kind of over the hump, but it was going to cost, you know, $200,000 to $300,000 over a few years to play professional golf. And, you know, diving into poker was, ironically, I think, the safe route.
That's a fantastic story. And, you know, I'm sitting here making notes. Because there were so many points there that that you brought up. I want to just touch on that last one where you say, you know, you thought there was going to be this huge rush from professional golfers to improve. But of course, you know, I think you said they're full of shit. That fascinates me because, you know, I've seen that in the world of professional trading as well. You know, that everyone thinks it's basically technical skills that are going to enable them to win, and they don't want to go to these places because they feel a little bit, I'm not sure, they feel a bit fluffy and woolly, and it's not part of their training. And it, you know, I was just working with and I hope I don't mind, it doesn't mind me saying, so I'm not going to mention his name, but a new client just recently who's a former amateur kickboxing champion. You know, he said that his teachers never worked on the mental game, and if they had done, he may have performed at a higher level. And he's really come to recognize this since starting to coach his own kickboxing cadre, of how important that is. And it's almost like since he's left, he's really come to realize that that is the gap, that is what's missing, you know. And they just try and say, almost suppress your emotions and keep the emotions out of it and just focus on the technique and the technical angle. And he said that's so wrong. And when he meets the best people, actually they've been working on the mental game either by themselves or with other people.
Absolutely.
But it's not something they talk about openly because it still has a bit of a stigma.
Agreed. And I think to some degree, rightfully so. I think there are professionals in this space that are, you know, a bit too kind of esoteric. There's not a lot of tangibility to it. There's not a lot of practicality or application. I mean, Trading in the Zone is a fantastic book, but I think the criticism tends to be like, okay, this is great, but how do I turn it into, you know, a transformational big difference in my mentality? And you know, to a degree, kind of that was what I was experiencing myself. That's what I, you know, have kind of done differently in my book. But, you know, to your points about, you know, the idea that like technique can overcome psychology, you know, defies the logic that psychology and emotions are a factor. And if you're not understanding the ways in which, you know, they are impacting your decision-making as a trader, as a poker player, impacting perhaps the decisions you make as a golfer, or actually fundamentally altering your technique and your swing and your putting stroke, you know, then you're missing a big opportunity. And I think if you look at, you know, the greats in any industry, you know, and no one would say that Michael Jordan didn't have mastery of his emotions, or Tiger Woods, or Roger Federer. You know, the giants, they all have had to work through, not overcome. I think the misconception is overcome. Overcome implies some kind of blocking out, denial, avoidance, suppression of. And yeah, in the moment, right, in key moments, you do have to be able to kind of block that out. But if you are continually doing that, they're just going to be undermining your performance. You know, and I think the calling out golfers is, you know, full of shit. It just sort of kind of speaks to the general overconfidence that professionals have, that people have. You know, golf by its nature kind of tends to lend to that. You know, the handicap system throws out your 10 worst scores. And so suddenly a 10 handicap golfer, you know, thinks that they're better than they are, right? Because their 10 worst scores have just been chucked out. So then when, you know, they're in the middle of the fairway, you know, with 100 yards and a pitching wedge in their hand, and they miss the green, they get pissed off. Well, it turns out you're not good enough to get pissed off about that, because your average shot is going to miss the green. And that's just math. You know, and so then we look at poker players and traders, and, you know, where does overconfidence show up? It shows up in a lot of subtle places. You know, I had a client who's featured in the book, and, you know, he was having, you know, a decent number of big kind of swings, right? So he would, you know, make 10,000 in a month and then have a 30% drawdown, and, you know, just go through these swings constantly. And it turned out that when he was setting goals for himself, he'd have a $10,000 month kind of the first time. And, you know, next month he wanted to make 100. So, like, what, you know, and just creating those kinds of subtle, you know, expectations of yourself can create a lot of emotional chaos. So, you know, for me, the way that I've kind of tried to get past the fuzziness of psychology and, you know, is to really look functionally, practically. So we don't look at the emotional problems as being the problem. They're just like a signal that we have to then kind of analyze and understand what it infers. So his overconfidence was a signal of excessive expectations, right? You look at somebody with a problem with FOMO, right? Their FOMO might be related to this belief that they can capture every opportunity. And on the surface, you say, well, that's illogical. Nobody could do that. But yet we have these deeper beliefs that we harbor. We have these illusions that we harbor in the back of our mind. And if you don't understand what they are, you know, then it's easy to just kind of rationalize through them. And for the most part, they're not going to affect you until you get into those key moments, right? Where, oh, all of a sudden, right, the market's moving, you know, you decided not to participate in a particular position because it didn't fit, you know, all five of your criteria. And then, you know, you can feel that need to get in. How are you going to stay on the sidelines, right? Because that belief is there. You have to, you're compelled to. And so there's no amount of technique that you can acquire that can solve for those kinds of emotions that come from those flaws. And we're not talking about deeper personal issues here. I mean, I think for me, one of the big insights that, you know, has kind of come through my experience, right? Yes, sometimes these issues are personal. And the way the book is structured, there's 310 pages in the book. The last two pages describe a story of a guy that I worked with whose issues got personal. The other 308 are all about the performance level. So we don't have to get personal to be able to have a bigger impact. You know, sometimes they have personal roots, but, you know, for a large measure, you know, we can talk about this stuff on a very practical terms.
I think it's very interesting that in terms of getting acceptance from people that are the target of coaching, let's call it that, you know, your client or whatever. I think it does very much, your effectiveness very much depends upon the language that you use. And of course, as soon as you start mentioning anything psychological, anything mental, anything to overcome, anything emotional, certainly men in particular get pretty uptight about accepting that they want to even go into those areas, you know, feeling that they're displaying a sort of weakness they don't want to own up to. You know, they almost own up to a physical weakness, but they won't own up to a mental weakness. And I think certainly the effectiveness of the coaching is then very dependent upon the way that the subject is wrapped, you know, and certainly around some of the sport. And it's the same, I think, for trading as well, that using the inner game as a conversation, as opposed to, you know, mental tuning or the mental game or the psychological game as a starting point, people will say, okay, well, you know, inner game, I can kind of relate to that. How can I then translate that to my outer game? And what symptoms are there or within my inner game that perhaps I need to be aware of, because actually a lot of the things I can change. And actually some of the things that Steve and I have pushed a lot in conversations is your general state of being, you know, and of course relaxed and flow state is something that is super important in terms of sport, as it is in terms of trading, better decisions, you know, faster decisions. And that state is very much often dependent upon how we managed ourselves yesterday. And some of that does depend on how we manage sort of personal things, you know, that only we want to sort of manage. And it's just making people realize that we're in this state of balance. The more we can be optimal, the better we perform. But we need to be aware of the fact that actually to notice that we've gone out of balance and to get ourselves back into balance is kind of the trick, really.
Yeah. And I think one of the ways to wrap that is to talk about this from, you know, very kind of like athletic terms. So, you know, you talk about being out of balance. Well, okay, well, what is going to be the signal of being out of balance, or what is going to be the signal of, you know, some pain points psychologically? And we can look at that as being no different than, you know, pain that comes from, you know, some kind of an injury to your ankle, right? And so that signal of pain is an indicator that there's something wrong that needs to be looked at. Okay. If you're experiencing excessive amounts of anger, greed, overconfidence, right, in your trading that's affecting you, we look at that as a signal of the problem. And that, I think, you know, that kind of language, I think, has kind of helped to break down, you know, some of those, you know, kind of barriers to the skepticism, because we can then kind of talk about it in just very functional terms, right? Rather than, okay, I'm getting upset, I'm getting, you know, fearful, and there's a lot of hesitation. That means that there's something wrong with me. That means that there's something weak inside. And the reality is, well, you wouldn't say the same thing about the injury to your ankle, right? But the signal of that problem comes up the same way. You know, if you had a headache, right, that headache is a signal of something. It can be a lot of different things. That's one of the most difficult, you know, I think, things to work through from the, you know, kind of mental and emotional side with traders, or really any professional, is that, you know, how do you kind of go through the process of identifying, okay, so, you know, here I am kind of forcing entry into these positions, or I'm over trading, or I'm, you know, kind of hesitating in these spots. What's the cause? Why is this happening? Because if you look at any of those three problems, they can be caused by literally every single mental or emotional issue that's out there. And so being able to kind of take it, right, that is the first indicator that you look at. And your job is to kind of dig in and begin to kind of map how it shows up. What are the thoughts that come to mind in those moments, or just before it, or just after it? What are the physical reactions that you have? Does your body create some tension? Do you have nervousness in your stomach, or, you know, tension in your hands? You know, what's the change in your decision-making process, right? The more we can kind of start to map what those reactions look like, then we begin the process of kind of peeling back the layers to identifying what those deeper flaws are. And that's really kind of how I organize the book. That's how I organize my coaching, so that, you know, kind of helps traders kind of step by step go through that process of taking this thing on the surface, the signal of a problem, and working it through to understand the cause. Because that really is the hardest thing. I mean, that is my greatest competency when I'm working with a client, is identifying very clearly on the surface what's going on and figuring out the root and doing that efficiently. It's the hardest thing for people who are not skilled in that. So, you know, I think that's why traders have had a hard time for a while. It's like there's so much information out there now. right? And they have to be the consumer of that information and properly work themselves through the system. You know, when I wrote my first book, I didn't realize that I was not qualified to hire an editor. I mean, I was never good in English and writing and learning. I mean, I was great at math. I was good in science, but you know, spelling, reading, writing, not my strengths. So, you know, I had to have, you know, a really bad experience with an editor who was not qualified to, you know, proofread a high school, you know, science paper, let alone, you know, a book, to realize how deep my incompetence was. And, you know, this time around, you know, I have a writing partner, you know, who was a former American Express, you know, VP in communications. She has hired lots of people. Right. And she was the one who was responsible for hiring the editor this time around. And she did an amazing job because, you know, and every trader that buys this book and benefits from it should be thanking the editor that we found, because, you know, a lot of good material, how you present it matters a lot. And she did an amazing job doing that. But my point, you know, is sort of just to say, right, we've kind of left the decision for how to actually take this psychological material that's out there about trading to the consumer, to every trader, to look through and say, okay, here's the problem that I have, you know, and here's the way it shows up, and to figure out how to solve it. And I think that's an incredibly difficult thing to do. So we take books, you know, that are out there now, and you know, again, how do you actually kind of work through the system? My book does not transform a lot of the material that's out there, right? It helps to funnel it in a very productive way by giving traders a system to go from, here's this problem that I see on the surface, to here's the cause of it at the underlying, you know, level, and here's the process for actually how to go through and correct it, much like you would correct that injury to your ankle.
See, what's interesting for me is hearing you talk about this, and I'm trying to put myself now in the shoes of the listener out there who is probably a trader, or maybe an investor, or maybe a poker player, or we have people who tune in who are involved in lots of different pursuits, or just curious. They're in business. They want to know how they can be more effective, more productive. And, you know, I was a trader for nearly 25 years. And I realized very early in my career that somehow getting the psychology right was more important to me than getting some sort of technical fix. So I found myself reading books on psychology. I mean, I read the Market Wizards books. You know, this is how old I am now. You know, I was a trader when they first came out. you know, I read them as they came out, and I reread them because there wasn't much else at that time. Obviously, I read Reminiscences, you know, of a Stock Operator. And there were a few early books on trading and trading psychology, not many. But they never, I never seemed to be able to adjust how I worked with it. By reading these, it was like I was reading a story about someone else. And I didn't change, even though I knew every fault that traders have. I both lived them myself and I read about them. But I didn't have that ability to see myself doing it. And in the moment, it's incredibly hard to have that self-awareness of what you're doing and how you're doing, and what parts of your system, your internal system, your ego, but also, you know, your nervous system, how they are working and functioning in those moments that are misdirecting your trading, particularly when they're key moments and the markets are firing up, or, you know, you've got a big position on. And I never was able to really get to that. And then I was very fortunate to work with a coach. It was almost by accident. I was working at a European bank as a trader, and we had a new head of trading joined us, and he wanted to bring in this coach that he'd used when he was a manager. So it was an executive coach rather than a sports coach. And he said, "Steve, I'd like you to work with him as a kind of guinea pig, because I want to try and bring him here into this bank." And yeah, you know, he knew, he could see that I was the one who was more interested in these, you know, this aspect of trading than just about anyone else. And even then, I pushed back. You know, we talk about professionals pushing back. You know, I was a bookworm on psychology, and yet as a professional trader, when working with a coach was put to me, you know, I'm like, get away, I'm a trader, I don't need coaching. You know, I was one of those idiots on the golf course that that you were kind of mentioning before, okay? Because your ego comes out. It does. You can't help it. That's who you are. That's how you function. That's how you roll. And you're thinking, you know, what are the guys around me going to think if they feel I'm, you know, we don't see a coach, we see a shrink, you know, which is, you know, a pejorative term more than anything. That's kind of how I viewed it at that point. So anyway, I was fortunate that the manager twisted my arm and I started working with this guy although it was an executive coaching program, we focused on me as a trader and how I brought myself to the job. And that was the biggest, and I've mentioned this many times in the podcast, the biggest single shot of, I don't know, power and development and energy into my trading. I mean, the next 10 years were completely different to the previous 15 years because I really got to learn and understand who I was and to start acting in different ways where I reflected on my performance and I was more conscious. You know, I'd never reflected in this way by having a coach who was actually trained in psychotherapeutic methods, you know, which is even more powerful. And, I guess you're trained as that, you know, because they know how to use what you're telling them. And to, you know, they are, it's a skill they have that you don't realize what a skill it is until, you know, when I became a coach myself 10 years later, and I still work with that coach now as a partner, and I went through that learning experience for about 5 years, that you don't quite realize how powerful it is until you actually learn it. And then you put it into practice. And the person you're working with doesn't realize that you are engaging with them whilst using these methods and tools. But this is the thing. It is so incredibly powerful. And when I heard you just now describe your book as it's not another version of, you know, Mark Douglas's brilliant book, and I do, it's one of my favorite books out there, but well, a couple of his books are my favorite books. But you're right, reading those books doesn't actually, you know, can help you develop your process, but it doesn't teach you how to improve, how to, you know, whereas something like a book which I highly recommend to people, The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin, that does. And I should imagine your book's probably a little bit more along those lines.
Yeah, a bit, but I'd say even Josh's book is less kind of, I don't want to say my book is formulaic, but I would say that it is very much a system. And I kind of lay it out like that because I want traders to understand that while they have strategies and systems for how they actually make trades and what they're looking at, and, you know, that they ought to have the same thing for their mental game. And so you sort of take this content, right? And you have to work it through a system in order for it to serve you and produce tangible outcomes in how you're responding in real time, in critical moments where, yeah, tilt, anger, overconfidence used to hijack your decision-making process. You want it to get to the point where it automatically doesn't do that. So I think one of the big sort of one of the myths that are out there is, yeah, exactly, and it's early here. One of the myths that are out there is this idea that like managing your problems is like the be all end all. And that's just functionally wrong, right? Because if we look at just functionality, the mind has a limited capacity. Okay. So if we look at thinking, right, if you have a thought in your head that occurs in a place called working memory, working memory has between 5 and 9 individual pieces of information you can weigh at one time. That number shrinks when your emotions rise. So if you are successfully able to manage your emotions, and let's say it doesn't actually consume some of those resources, you are still using some of those resources to defend yourself against your emotions. So it is functionally impossible for you to have the correct perception of the market, the correct interpretation of how your strategy and system lines up in these critical moments. It's functionally impossible. So, and that was exactly what was happening for me when I was choking on the golf course, right? I didn't have that clarity and that freedom. You know, Mark, you said it earlier about, you know, getting in the zone, getting in that, having that very clear-minded space, you know, whatever energy you sort of feel in that moment where it's relaxed or intense, it doesn't matter. It's just, you're in the zone because there's so much space, right? If you're occupying resources to defend yourself, then you're not free to be actually be in the zone. That is what the system is designed to do. It's designed to permanently resolve the source of the problem, right? And again, we're not dealing with, you know, deeper seated issues. Of course, yes, that can happen. But for the most part, we're just trying to fundamentally alter and correct these underlying performance flaws. And when you do that, right, your emotions go away because then you've actually solved the problem and the signal of fear, greed, FOMO, right? They disappear. Right? They no longer serve the purpose. If you fix the injury to your ankle, right, you're not going to continue to feel pain.
Can I stop you there for a second and just kind of zoom in on this word choking? Because I know Mark as a golfer
chokes regularly,
and yep. I suppose you've come across this often, and as someone who coaches golfers,
absolutely
right. Yeah. And I'm always minded when I talk about this of the golfer. I think it was John Vandeveld and that hole in the 1999 British Open.
Oh yeah, preceded by a little bit of overconfidence hitting driver on the tee.
He was smashing it. He was about to win a major. For possibly the only time in his career, or maybe the first time in his career, we don't know,
and we never know.
He was sitting on the edge of greatness, and then it all collapsed on one hole. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how far was ahead. Ahead was he of the field?
Three shots,
and it was two holes to go. Is that correct?
Last hole, he had three shots.
Last hole. Yeah. I mean, it is. You know, bless him. It's painful to watch. You know, if you ever look at it on YouTube. We will return to the podcast shortly. First, a quick word about our podcast sponsor. This podcast is sponsored by the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. We are delighted to be able to promote their brilliant STA Technical Analysis Home Study Course. Listeners to the Alpha Mind podcast interested in studying for the Home Study Course can get an exclusive discount by visiting the Alpha Mind blog page, where they can find a link to the Home Study Course at the top of the page. Go to alphamindblog.blogspot.com or just Google Alpha Mind blog. Now back to this week's podcast.
An interesting point about this sense of choking, because actually, if you watch people on a golf course, there was some guy some months ago when we were allowed to play golf. There was this very young guy, but he just had a peach of a swing in his practice shot. Okay, he then addressed the ball, and that peach of a swing disappeared.
Charles Barkley-esque.
Yeah, because overthinking suddenly came into the equation. And I remember decades ago, I played a golf day with some financial guys. And there was one guy, he was like older than the rest of us, he was like 65 or something like that. And he had these useless clubs, but he had a five handicap. And I said, where is this guy getting his power and his sort of direction from? And I was noticing that as he hit the ball, he didn't have a practice shot, but he then started looking at the trees. And what he was doing, he was bird watching in between shots. So he was tuning into his environment. He was not pre-thinking the shot, and he was turning up fresh to shot when he got to the ball and played it without a practice swing. In other words, he'd cut out all the crap and emotion stuff that gets in the way of, I guess, pulling the trigger and getting the right weight, I guess, the right wrist, the right direction, all that thing to the ball. But of course, there's so many overlaps with trading. But I learned a big lesson from this guy that, you know, the ability to tune out of, you know, until you get to the actual decision was actually making him a fantastic golfer. And I think there's a huge overlap with trading, the pre-trading, the pre-thinking. It's going to get to here. It's going to get to there. It's going to get there in this time. And duration to trade profitability is often forgotten, because sometimes you don't have the time to stay in a trade. You kind of run out of time. And that becomes something that becomes counterproductive to you. But yeah, some big lessons learned there. And I think going back to your symptomatic approach to the formula, and Steve mentioned it and what he summed up a moment ago, it's got to start with awareness. Because if you're not being aware of just what's going on, the chances are you're not going to be spotting the symptoms. You're just going to be carrying on and carrying on making the same mistake and the same mistake.
Yeah, the word that I use is recognition, because I think it's sort of one step past awareness. Awareness to me says I can sense and perceive what's kind of happening. And that's a really important first step. So absolutely, we're in alignment there. But the recognition is the important next step, where you say, ah, when I'm having this particular thought, it means that this flaw has emerged. And now, you know, because I've gone through the system, here's the correction. And you can use your mind in that moment to try to correct the thought by not fighting against the thought, but by fighting against the flaw that produced it. So, you know, you take somebody who, you know, has, you know, an illusion of control or some belief that they can, you know, predict the direction of the market, right? And so, you know, they have that thought just before, you know, they're going to enter a trade, and they have this feeling like, ah, okay, this one's going to be a winner, right? It comes up as a reflex. Okay, that is not a conscious thought. It's a very important thing to recognize, right? You know, you're aware in that moment and recognize that that thought means that my system has reacted, that I believe on some level that I know what's going to happen in this trade. And of course, logically, we all know that you don't, but in that moment, a part of you does. And that's the thing that you're fighting against. So you're not fighting against the, you know, am I going to win the, you know, or I believe I'm going to win this trade. It's fighting against the flaw that you believe that you're right, right? The belief that you have the power to predict the future. You know, effectively, you're a shitty psychic, and you need to realize that in that moment, right? That your job is not to predict the future. Your job is to make probabilistic bets based on a system that has proven that, you know, probability will pay out.
This, I'm trying to think here of, from what you said there, of the crossover between poker, trading, and we could say just about anything, you know, which requires that ability to make a decision in the moment. And I think that's what choking really reflects. It's that ability in that moment to be able to act as you would 99.9% of the time when the pressure's not on. It's to take in the penalty in the final minute of a, we call it soccer, we call it football, you call it soccer, of a soccer match in a big competition. You know, it's that winning putt. It's, you know, in poker, I guess it's the, Do you see, or do you fold, do you call?
Yeah, but do you raise? You're talking like kind of the scale of the failure. I mean, I think when we talk about choking, to me, I just look at it along kind of a spectrum of severity, you know, and for a lot of the players that I've worked with who've struggled with that issue, you know, it really does help to kind of focus it like that, because it's never like choking is just sort of an accumulation of a lot of issues that come together and cause the severity of the reaction to be so severe that their system shuts down and there's no thinking, right? So the poker equivalent would be, you know, you're staring at a spot on a river and, you know, and you've got to decide whether to go all in or not. And here you are, you know, tanking, as they call it, where you're just sort of sitting there thinking, but there's actually no thoughts. It's just a complete blue screen in your head, and there's total shutdown. You're sitting there for a minute. You haven't had one single productive thought. That's like kind of the mental equivalent of choking as a golfer, where, you know, you shank it on the 17th hole of, you know, the TPC Sawgrass into the water and, you know, lose the tournament. So the severity of an issue like that is never a single thing. It's usually, you know, many different kind of underlying flaws that come together. And when you start to kind of break it apart, you know, you can start to solve each one individually. And, you know, to have that kind of sustainable improvement where, yeah, you can go back into a similar spot. You know, it's not going to be first time out where, you know, you're not going to choke at all, right? We're looking for, you know, degrees of improvement where, you know, okay, so you're faced with a very big trade. Let's say, you know, here you are, you know, the type of trader who, you know, relies on big moves in the market. You know, you are, you know, you make 90% of your profit from 10% of your trade. So even kind of more lopsided than some traders. And so you're sensing a big opportunity coming, but you've had some failures before. You're in a drawdown. You kind of need this one to kind of get you out of it. And there's just this huge bit of pressure and you hesitate, right? It's the thing that kind of sets up over days. You just can't pull the trigger. You know, the move takes off and you get into a, you know, kind of if at all. You know, we're not looking for the scale of that problem to go from 100 to zero in a day, right? We're looking for it to go from, you know, 100 to 90, 90 to 80, right? And every time you look at what that kind of the chopping away at that is, it's very often, you know, several different factors, several different flaws, you know, that need to kind of come together. But they often typically have an accumulation of emotion over time, right? You know, Mark, you talked earlier about how, you know, how you are kind of outside of your life can kind of transfer over, you know, to the next day. And that is true. And also how you operated the day before can transfer over. So one of the reasons that, you know, traders typically struggle in, you know, sideways markets or even in a drawdown for themselves is because there is some emotion that's accumulating day over day, right? There's this impulse in a sideways market to like want to trade and want to get in, and it gets bigger and bigger day over day, right? That there's an accumulation of that tension, right? If you're struggling and you're getting down on yourself, right? There's an accumulation day over day. So, you know, you're not completely reset. You're starting with, you know, some level of emotion, you know, every single day, and it grows to the point where, you know, eventually it causes you to just kind of completely fail, you know, right out of the gate. And so that kind of accumulated emotion, you know, is a big kind of X factor when we look at what causes choking.
So do you think if you go back to your golf that time you choked, how old were you? Was there an element of experience about that maybe if you'd have, you know, had more experience, more time, even worked with someone like you, that would have dissipated? Or, you know, what I'm just curious about that, what your views are.
Yeah, I mean, I 100%. I mean, I now know kind of more of what those flaws were that kind of occurred thereafter. But I think the first time I choked, I was inexperienced to feel pressure to that scale, which is not a problem, right? It's not a problem to experience that. But, you know, putting was always my biggest technical weakness. So the subtleties of that size of pressure just preyed on that technical weakness. And so, yeah, I've gotten a lot more sort of psychologically stronger as I've gotten older and really kind of peeled back, you know, many of the, you know, overconfidence issues that I had, some of the high expectations that, you know, kind of preyed on me. And then, of course, when you have some struggles and failures, right, you know, that can kind of cause some doubt and, you know, things that kind of occur afterwards. But, you know, I really think the simple answer for the first time that I choked would have been, you know, just to realize that pressure is no different than a distraction, right? If I got, you know, anybody listening to this or even the two of you to just focus on the feeling of your feet on the floor or, you know, how your butt feels in your chair, right? And you are just going to keep focusing on those two points while I'm talking, you're going to recognize that it becomes hard to distinguish, you know, kind of which sensory input you're going to focus on, right? And it's not to say that you can't keep hearing me, you can't keep feeling your feet in the chair, your butt, feet on the floor, your butt in the chair, but it becomes harder to peel those apart. So what kind of nerves and anxiety does, it takes your focus inward, right? And it makes me focus on my body and the sensations that my body's feeling. And it's just a distraction. They're not material. I learned in a tournament a couple of years after this. It was qualifying for the US Amateur. First hole, I you know, hit two pretty good shots, just, you know, short-sided myself in a very tough greenside bunker, knocked it to 4 feet, which was a fantastic shot because bunker play was not a strength. And I got over that 4-foot putt and my hands were literally shaking. I could see them moving, backed off, reset myself. And I just said, it doesn't matter. It's not material. And I got up there and just drilled it in the back of the hole. Right. And so you start to realize that your body has these automatic processes that are built in place. If I start to focus on my body doing something that I don't think it should, right, that's a flaw. That in itself can cause problems. And I think for me, right, yes, I needed to work on my putting technique. It needed to get better, right? Especially on short putts where the pressure is higher, you know, the expectations are greater. But had I focused more on the line, getting myself prepared, doing a little breathing so that my focus was on that, not on my system, you know, I probably would have made one or two more putts. Probably wouldn't have made all of them, right? But I would have made more of them. But again, you know, I think as I've gotten on, you know, there were, you know, certainly a handful of other flaws that needed to be ferreted out and corrected too. So,
but that's interesting because that comes down to that marginal gains element. You know, you're not going to go from, you know, a good amateur to someone who's ready to win a major overnight. It's an incremental improvement process. You know, small marginal gains that eventually add up to a big game. So, and there's so many parts that need to be improved. There's a new challenge that you wouldn't have even thought about or become aware of. You know, that by breaking this down, you slowly start to become aware of both the bigger issues and the smaller issues.
Yeah, that's a really good point because the power of incremental gains, you know, is that you create sustainability. Okay. The people that don't have that very profound bedrock of competence and experience, you know, they're the ones that become the flash, make a ton of money and are gone, right? They're the golfers that show up out of nowhere, you know, and they're gone. You know, the number of people that have won one PGA Tour event versus multiple is absurd. So it's easy to kind of get there. Sustaining it is harder, but you know, the way to do that in my mind is sustainable progress, that incremental improvement. So that's a great point.
Yeah. I was just minded because this seems to be a theme of something we're talking about from a brilliant podcast called On the Sporting Couch, which was a few years ago. It's a British based podcast. And there was an interview with a boxer called Johnny Nelson. And, you know, I find boxing is often a great analogy for trading. You know, that self against, you know, you really, you know, you are as much the enemy as the opponent in the ring, you know. And, you know, he talked about, I mean, this guy was a cruiserweight world champion and he had huge potential. You know, he was a man mountain with a great punch at a very early age. He was expected to win his first world championship. He was thrown in there at a young age, but he actually froze on the day. He kind of choked, and he ended up with a draw, which turned out to be like losing for him and for everyone who supported him and backed him, because technically he was so gifted. And it haunted him for years. And it's a great podcast because you listen to him go back and he said, well, I had to relearn. I wanted to relearn. You know, I wanted to go back to basics. You know, he was at that point of being that one-hit wonder who'd had a good start to his career. And then you hit that psychological barrier. You know, for a trader, it might be a large drawdown. And a lot of them never come back from that. They never recover. Their confidence is shattered. Their belief in themselves is shattered. And you know, it's a great podcast because he talked about how he got his confidence back. And it took a few years and he went back to fight at the very basic level, almost as a sparring partner and a fighter away out of the limelight in another country. And then, you know, he came back and he eventually 5 or 6 years later became a cruiserweight world champion. And I think held the longest ever cruiserweight world champion. But, you know, we see that often in training, but not many people come back because you've got this problem of needing the income as well.
Yeah, and there's a lot of uncertainty, right? He's got a team of people around him, right? He's kind of helping. You've got to find your own way, you know, too. But I think a lot of traders don't necessarily know, again, what they need to focus on. When your confidence gets shattered, you just have to look at that as a symptom. Right, it's not an indictment on you as a person, and that distinguishing point is really key because then you can actually do something about it. If you're the problem, what the hell is the solution? Right, get a new you. Like, well, what are we talking about here? This isn't the Matrix where we can just like wipe your memory, wipe your consciousness, and you know insert somebody else. Like, so you're not the problem, right? That's another underlying flaw is believing that you're the problem, right? So if your confidence is shattered. It was shattered for reasons, typically overconfidence, high expectations, illusions of control, right? And when you are able to kind of go back and look at, right, the specific signals that indicate which problem it was, right? Whether it was high expectations or an illusion of control, right? You've got to kind of do, you know, the diagnostics to figure out which one. Again, that's what the book kind of guides traders through, to be able to figure out what's at the heart of this thing. Because you don't want to rebuild your confidence the way that it was before. It was based on these flaws. It wouldn't have broken if that wasn't the case.
And so what I'm hearing you say is it sounds like it's a real ego state, where when everything was going great, you thought it's because of your brilliance and your gift. And then suddenly when it all falls apart, you think it's you, that you're flawed and you're not capable of it. And, you know, whereas really, you know, you have to try and remove as much of that ego centricity as much as possible and realize that, you know, you were on a bit of a roll when you were on the up. It was your process. It was what you're doing. It was working. But also maybe the situation was favorable for you, you know, and you just happened to be surfing that. And you weren't as good as you thought. And equally, when you suffer the setback, it helps to stand back and think, you're not as bad as you think you are. It's not really your fault. You've got to get your head around this process and understand that, you know, it's not always going to be, you know, we're dealing with uncertainty and randomness and, you know, markets that at one moment they're trending and the next they're not. One moment they're extremely volatile, then they're not. You know, and the circumstances will be different for everyone, and how you manage through that. And then to bring it back to yourself and have an egocentric view is where the confidence suddenly falls away from you.
I mean, one of the common flaws, right, that produces overconfidence also produces a lack of confidence. And that's believing that you're in more control of your results than is real, right? So when you're getting confirmation that that's the case, you're going to feel overconfident. When you're getting confirmation that that's not the case, you're going to lose confidence, right? Predicting the future is another one, right? When you feel like, oh, you know, I'm going to make a killing today, or today's my day, or, you know, you had a good month. And of course, then the next month is going to be great. There's this feeling of optimism, right? But it's false because you can't control it. So the overconfidence comes as a result of that. But then when your results are going poor, now you start to, again, the same flaw of predicting the future or believing that your predictions are real, then produces negative outcome or negative confidence when the results go sideways or you make a few mistakes. But the flaw that centers on it is either of those two things. It just sort of depends on the situation that kind of predicts it. And, you know, I think a lot of my clients who were lacking confidence were sort of surprised to learn that they were actually overconfident, right? And it's that kind of thing we talk about, again, packaging. That kind of thing helps to kind of get the hamster wheel turning a little bit differently, right? When you talk to somebody who's feeling like shit, that you're actually full of shit, instead of that gets them to see a different perspective. And a lot of times, you know, a different perspective is really kind of what's called for.
You know, it's interesting because it leads into a question which I was going to ask you, which was actually put forward by one of our listeners. I mentioned, he tweeted me and said, are you ever going to do an episode on regrets? Okay, so his name is Nanaimo Trader. That's his Twitter handle, if he's listening. I said, well, funny enough, we've got a psychologist coming on the phone. On the phone? What am I talking about? I'm going to edit that bit out. We've got a psychologist coming on the show. And, you know, he's a coach who's done great work, mental work with traders, well, with poker players over the years, and he's also working with traders. And I'd be great for me to put that to him. So he asked me, you know, he said, you know, this is what he struggles with, you know, more than anything else, is having those regrets when those rare opportunities happen. And he doesn't fully take advantage of it by putting the size on. And I guess I wanted to get your take on it. It's not an easy answer, I know. So sorry if I put you on the spot. But I'd love to hear what you say about that. And also, I'd love to hear your take on that as well, Mark, afterwards, if we can go on to that.
Yeah, I mean, regret happens for a variety of reasons, okay? So one reason can be the belief that you should have taken the trade. You should have capitalized on the full opportunity. And again, when you can fully kind of accept that you weren't good enough in that moment to have seen that, the regret can start to become, you know, a little bit lessened, and you can instead become emboldened to actually just get better. You know, again, some of that overconfidence can falsely let you believe that you were more capable than you were. Because frankly, if you were fully capable, you would have taken the trade. Right? There's a reason why you couldn't. And you need to look more pragmatically and practically at why you couldn't. And yes, there may be some additional flaws that are associated with that, you know, but like we, you know, we look at like the hindsight bias, for example, right? Hindsight bias is a huge reason for why people hang on to these regrets. But when we look at the hindsight bias, and, you know, golfers are fantastic at this. My father, who I'll throw into the bus for a second, is notorious at, you know, getting off the golf course and turning an 87, you know, into a 79 or an 80 in like 4 seconds. Ah, you know, if I didn't make triple here, if I didn't, you know, I should have made that putt there. You know, all of a sudden, right? You didn't. Okay, the score is what it is. Okay, yeah, maybe you got a little unlucky, but you know what? You weren't good enough to hit that shot at that particular time. So get back on the driving range, get back in the putting green, and get better. Right. And so the hindsight bias is really kind of this wacky thing, okay? Because effectively you believe that one day you're going to just wake up and automatically be as good as you believe you ought to have been to have taken that trade, to have hit that shot, to have made that putt, to have made that call if you're a poker player, okay? Rather than actually doing the work to be able to be good enough to do that. And maybe there are some additional mental and emotional things to work out, right? Maybe there is some fear that was present. Okay, but that's a separate issue from the regret. Okay, and a lot of times the impact of mental and emotional factors are so kind of diminished as a factor for what produced the failure, right? That they get kind of thrown away and not considered as relevant. So, you know, I think when I look at, you know, some of the players that I've worked with who have had some regrets, right? They didn't really understand some of those mental and emotional factors that were present and just assumed that it would be easy.
Mm. So from my perspective, I think it's very much a case of the recovery rate. I mean, shocks and regrets are going to happen. But the quicker you can lose that state and get back to an optimal state, I guess, being fresh to see the opportunity, the next opportunity, the better. And it's the dwelling on regret, as you say, is an absolute disaster for many. But I think knowing that you've got the intention to get yourself back to an optimal state, and we've covered the breath, and I think that's the great thing. Accessing fresh air is another method of doing it. And really just, you know, getting fresh to trade. I mean, it's as simple as that. And I think we have to accept that bad stuff will happen. And we just need to realize that to be opportunistic about the trading world, we need to be able to reset and recalibrate ourselves and get ourselves optimal as fast as possible. And it's the intention to do that, I think, that's really, really important. So you've got the awareness, you've got the recognition of the state. You then need an intention to get yourself back into an optimal state to then face the fact that, well, the market's not gone away and it's still there to see where the opportunity is. There you go. That's due to silence. Yeah.
Do you want me to respond? I wasn't sure who was who.
No. That's the issue with the podcast. I mean, I was actually taken by, for a second, I was studying the picture of Albert Einstein on the wall behind you, which our viewers can't see. But we've got two very interesting, Mark and Jared have got two very interested, Mark and Jared. Yes, behind them. Mark has got his drinks cabinet in the corner over there, which is wetting my lips a little bit. Yeah. And you've got a fascinating picture of Einstein with some fantastic words.
Yeah, so you can't see it, but I had this commissioned. It was I took my 10 favorite Einstein quotes, and he was able to kind of feather them into the picture. The one on the top is my favorite. It's you don't really understand something until you can explain it to your grandmother. yeah, I mean, honestly, that's like kind of the ethos that I take with my work. You know, I'm dealing with a lot of my grandmothers, and I take that, you know, to heart. I think making psychological concepts really simple and actionable and practical is, I think, really important to broadening, you know, the appeal for, you know, the people that don't naturally have an inclination towards it and the ones who are more skeptical.
That really captures the whole challenge of working in this space. You know, it's not a technical issue, you know, and we all see our own experiences through a different lens. through a very personal lens. And, you know, what I suppose this is the challenge of working with people is almost getting the same language and, you know, getting to understand what something means to them. And I think this was part of what I was saying before when I was trying to read about psychology. I was reading about it as if it happened to other people and not seeing how these issues were affecting me or even being conscious of them or recognizing them. In fact, you know, when they happen, it is so hard to spot them because you are not an observer of yourself.
Yeah, you have to train yourself to do that. I think, you know, traders fortunately have the skill of observation, right? They have spent hours studying markets and charts, patterns, styles of trading, styles of thinking about investing. And yet they haven't kind of done the same thing to themselves. So if we look at like kind of the ratio of that, you know, all we're trying to do is just like kind of bring up the other side. And, you know, the book is really designed to help them to study their own patterns in the mental and emotional side, you know, so that they can actually take some action. You can't fix a problem that you can't see in the moment. Right. And if you see the opportunity afterwards, right, whether it's a, you know, a trading opportunity, right, it's gone. The money's gone. Right. If you don't see that you are pissed off prior to actually taking a trade for the third time after getting stopped out twice, if you don't see that ahead of time, right, you're going to take the third trade and you're going to lose. Right. And so it's just a skill that you can train over time. It's not some mythical, you know, magical ability for people to be aware of their emotions. I was an idiot when I was 18 and it's taken me, you know, years of study. So.
But when you said that, that's quite interesting because that, you know, there's a theme we've touched on a few times in this conversation without really delving to that much. For example, when I was offered the coach, I pushed back and said, no way, you know, you called yourself an idiot when you were 18. And I think, you know, we've talked about the hesitancy of people to go and see a coach, you know, or to see a therapist. And I think somewhere there's a fear that they're going to find out things about themselves that they're not going to like, or that they're going to uncover some sort of flaws, which is the wrong way to look at it. You know, and I often tell people, you know, Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, the greatest sports people in the world, they actively seek out coaches because they want to get
better.
They
actively seek out their weaknesses.
They want to understand.
Yeah, they view everyone at the top. They view unknown weaknesses as the biggest threat to their performance, to their operation, right? And they are ruthless at fixing them. So I 100% agree with you. Right? There's this mythology that's out there that, you know, if you uncover weaknesses, that there's something wrong, and it's the exact opposite. Not knowing your weaknesses is the bigger weakness.
And ironically, that's what actually stops a lot of people seeking out coaching. You know, it's not even the money for many of them. For many of them, it's, do I really want to go there? Do I want to find things that I'd rather not find? Well, yes, you do. And you should. And it's going to have a dramatic impact on your game in ways that you can't possibly imagine. So that's why I was considered it very lucky. My arm was twisted into going to that.
As was mine. I mean, I was out of necessity. I had to find an answer. Otherwise, I was going to, you know, be destined to a life that I didn't want to live. Yeah. But I think, you know, when you look at the choice that people have to make about whether or not to engage in this process or not, you know, I think the other thing is they kind of fail to look at the lost opportunity and the opportunity cost of not kind of doing something, right? Because you're either going to choose to underperform for the rest of your career, because it's not possible to, you know, for most traders to reach the levels that they want without actively getting better, you know, in their psychology, right? The ones who naturally have those abilities and don't need to work on it as actively as others, you know, kind of have that just kind of luck factor that they have that, you know, it's the talent equivalent of being, you know, an elite athlete. But for most people, they have to work on it actively in order to fulfill their potential. Otherwise, right? So it's the choices, short-term pain, short-term discomfort, short-term uncertainty, as you begin to kind of peel back the layers and figure out what is undermining your performance, or long-term, you're sort of destined to just never fulfill your potential.
Yeah, I mean, trading is such a psychological activity, as is poker. I mean, you must see that. I mean, the similarities that you must have come across between them must have. Did they surprise you or catch you off guard at all?
Well, I mean, I think so. When I went from golf to poker, that was sort of the big surprise, was like just kind of how similar they were. And, you know, you sort of think about like the degree of variance, the degree of luck that's involved. And it's like, you know, golf has a pretty good amount of it. You look at the playing conditions, you know, as being a big source of that. But you know, poker just has more of it, and then, but yeah, like the things that poker players and golfers go through are the exact same thing. It's just sort of the conditions of competition that change, the demands of their mentality that change. But then when we look from poker to trading, yeah, it is very similar in terms of the issues that traders or poker players face. But I think there are some very big distinct advantages that traders have over poker players because, you know, for one, the decision-making process for some traders, you know, can take days, right? There's an advantage there. There's a disadvantage there, right? But for the most part, when we're dealing with like the emotional stuff, if you're a poker player, you are kind of locked in place. You have to be there. You know, traders have the ability to kind of walk away and kind of go in and out and manage themselves and deal with those issues. So I think there are some advantages to traders, but then, you know, the scale of what we're dealing with is a much bigger playing field for a lot of people. And, you know, when there's more on the line, you know, those emotional issues just get drawn out in bigger form and it becomes harder to manage.
Okay. Well, listen, just, I mean, I'm conscious of the time and we've got to wrap this up in a minute, but how could people find out about you? How could people find out about your book? Again, repeat the title of the book and where they can, Where they can, I assume they could purchase it on Amazon, but where else?
Yeah, I mean, they should be able to purchase it everywhere books are sold. You know, it's the Mental Game of Trading, a system for solving problems with greed, fear, anger, confidence, and discipline. It's on Audible, you know, audiobook, ebook. You know, if it's not, you know, at your local bookstore, just ask for it and they'll ship it to you. And you know, online, you know, I'm fairly active on Twitter, which is at Jared Tendler. My website is jaredtendler.com. So those are kind of the big places to find me.
Okay, brilliant. Brilliant. Mark, any thoughts that before we wrap up that you want to just, or anything you want to ask?
It's just we're so lucky to have Jared on. I think it's super topical. You know, AlphaMind itself is exploding in interest across markets because we've not really thought about this side of us before. It's only really coming to the agenda now that this is where your game is. This is where your edge is. And I think, as you pointed out, not knowing your weakness is the biggest weakness. And this stuff doesn't come easy. It's about intention and commitment and really putting work into it and really actively working to improve it, and making a habit, a positive habit of some of these processes as well. And that takes a lot of doing. That will take effort, but it'll be effort that will translate into you having a better chance of performing in nasty, volatile, whatever environments, be that trading, be that golf, be that whatever you're getting involved with. But, you know, it's so interesting. Pardon?
All the fun stuff.
All the fun stuff. The fun that we all want to get involved in and think we're going to be successful and wonder why we're not. And we're often not, because we tend to be getting in our own way, and realizing that. And with the awareness that's required and the recognition and then the intention of actually doing something about it is what your book is all about. So we wish you great luck with the book, and we'll certainly be on the purchasing list for it. But thanks again. Been a real pleasure, Jared.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Real pleasure to have me on, and I'm appreciate the time and the thoughtfulness and you know, interest in this field. I'm happy to be, you know, surrounded by people trying to push it forward. So it's great talking to you guys.
Thank you, Jared. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this week's AlphaMind podcast. If you have enjoyed this podcast or any of our past podcasts, we would be delighted if you could rate the podcast on whichever service you use, or even better, leave a review. Thank you also to our podcast sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. You can go to technicalanalysts.com to find out more about their services and to explore becoming a member of the STA. As a reminder, at Alpha Mind, we focus on trader and investor personal growth and development. We offer coaching programs which are geared towards developing the key human, personal and behavioral skills that are so vital in helping people grow their performance and take their trading or investing to a higher level. Our clients come from a range of backgrounds from across the world. These include leading portfolio managers working at some of the world's largest hedge funds, asset management firms and sovereign wealth funds. We also work with investment banks and some of the world's largest commodity and energy trading businesses. Our clients also come from a myriad of other backgrounds, including family offices, proprietary trading firms, as well as many serious private retail traders. In addition to trade and investor coaching, our services extend to executive, leadership and team coaching with a specialist focus on financial markets, investment and risk businesses. To know more about our services, visit our webpage alpha-mind.net or email us info@alpha-mind.net or visit the Alpha Mind blog page for more contact information. If you would like to sign up for our regular newsletter, you can do so on the page link at the top of the Alpha Mind blog, and you can also listen to our podcasts on our new Alpha Mind YouTube channel. Finally, you can follow us and connect with us on social media. We are active on LinkedIn in our own names, Stephen Goldstein and Mark Randall, or through the Alpha Mind group on LinkedIn, which has over 15,000 members. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handles are AlphaMind101 and AlphaMind102. We wish you well, stay safe, and have a great week.